I would say understanding the far right today is one of the most important political questions that left-wing people, anti-fascists, Marxists, anyone that considers themselves on the side of humanity against barbarism, it's the most important thing to grapple with at the moment, alongside other questions like imperialism and resistance. You'd have to be an absolute fool not to recognize that the far right's on the march everywhere. I'm guessing that's why you're here. But also be oblivious to the monstrosities that these people represent. Just having a look at what Trump's doing in America, and the far right internationally getting a boost out of this. These people want to make all of our lives infinitely worse than they already are. They represent everything that's cruel and horrible about capitalism, and they want to make it infinitely worse. The last time that the far right had seen this much comparable success is in the 1920s and the 1930s, what people usually call the interwar period. And they, in one sense, they're right. Like, if you look at the success, the ability to influence the mainstream and what have you, it's the closest we've been to that era in any of the preceding decades. At the same time, I think the 1920s and 1930s were a very, very different period to the period that we're in today. Namely, like, the depth of the capitalist crisis is nowhere near comparable. The levels of class struggle, nowhere near comparable. These were eras of world wars, revolutions, counter-revolutions, the economic crisis, infinitely worse than it is today, and the solutions that the capitalist class wanted to provide to it. So what I want to do is, like, take some of the lessons that we can learn from the interwar period, but not in the sense of, like, just trying to mechanically measure up the present to the 1920s and 30s and go, oh, does it match up to it? Is it as bad? Blah, blah, blah. And do these formations fit into these categories that we can generate from that? I don't think that's a very useful way of looking at politics. We need to actually understand the dynamics of the present. Taking the 20s and 30s as a reference point, though, you can understand why things look a particular way back then and why they do now. And that, I think that's key for anyone who wants to genuinely fight the far right. So I'm going to do four things. I'm going to set the scene. Like, what does this moment look like for the far right? What are its features? I want to briefly sketch how we got here. How the fuck have we ended up in this mess? What are the forces facilitating their growth? Develop a deeper understanding of the enemy we face. Like, how is it different and similar to some of the formations that emerged in the 1920s and 1930s? And above all, I want to inform what we can do today about this mess that we're in. How can we stop them? How can we defeat them? So you're going to get the worst of both worlds in this talk. It's not just going to be about the far right, but I'm going to have to cover a lot of territory and I'm going to speak very, very fast. So strap yourselves in. Okay, I'll start by setting the scene. Oh, that's the summary. What does this moment look like for the far right? What are its features? I think, like, this guy back in the Trump house, in the White House, the Trump House, that's what he's trying to turn it into, really puts the far right at the pinnacle of the world's most violent and powerful state. And unlike his first administration, it's not hampered by his own party being, trying to sabotage and oppose everything he's trying to do. Trump's control over the Republican Party is pretty much absolute. He's totally marginalized the moderate Republicans in that party. And that agenda that he's trying to carry out now is much more radical than the first time around. It consists of, I think, three interrelated aspects. One is ruthless class war, rule for the rich, try and transfer masses and masses amount of wealth upwards through tax cuts to the rich, mass sackings by, his Nazi billionaire mate, Elon Musk. Secondly, an authoritarian reordering of an already very, very violent and authoritarian state. So you look at the mass deportations that he's been carrying out, political dissidents being snatched off the streets, de potentially deported to gulags in El Salvador, whipping up intense nationalism, bigotry against anyone deemed unpatriotic, doesn't fit into the, correct gender norms and all that sort of stuff. And thirdly, an aggressive imperialist strategy that's about trying to reassert US imperial power against its main rival, which is China, and making all of its allies much more subservient to US power. So we saw that with the trade war. We saw that with, like, berating Zelensky. We see that with, all of the stuff that he's trying to do around getting countries to remilitarize, increase their military spending, threatening to annex territories, anything that's, basically seen as in the interest of the US, just very aggressively and openly championing that. And even promoting far-right political formations across the world, such as the Fascist Party in Germany, the Alternative for Deutschland. So it's not just in the US, though, that the far right is influential. They're in power in a number of countries. So I can't list them all, but there's Orban in Hungary, Putin in Russia, Meloni in Italy, Modi in India, Milei in Argentina, Netanyahu in and his far-right coalition in Israel. These regimes have become an inspiration for the far-right internationally. So one example is Orban. Like, Hungary would be, I've lived there, Hungary would be an irrelevant shithole to the world if it was not this far-right regime that's become an inspiration for Trump. Literally, his Project 2025 program, that's a, this laundry list of executive orders that he wants to carry out and he is carrying out, is literally was drawn up in by the think tank of Orban's regime. So like they've been working together to try and figure out how can you restrict democratic rights. Like if you look at Hungary and also Russia, they have parliamentary elections, so you can't really just say it's an outright dictatorship, but the political space is so limited. Like there's basically no independent press. All these constitutional changes have happened. We've shut down universities and other institutions that are deemed oppositional and subversive. Mass sackings of the state bureaucracy, replacing those people with pliant bureaucrats and so on. So it gives you a sense of like, this is the type of regime that the far right wants to create. There's also this guy in Argentina, Milei. His austerity and attacks in Argentina have been a direct inspiration for Trump's Doge department. And of course, you've got Israel. Basically, the far right loves this state because it's sort of militaristic, apartheid, ethno-nationalist state that the far right wants to see created in their own countries. And so when they're not in power, they're actually able to set the pace of politics in a lot of countries and be, a really visible part of the mainstream. So parties with roots in the interwar fascist period, such as the FPÖ in Austria or the National Front, National Rally, whatever they're called now, in France, they're like in Austria last year, they won the general election. They would have like formed government, but they didn't for various reasons that I can't go into right now. But also in Germany, you've got the Alternative for Deutschland. They came second in the elections earlier this year. But this is a party that says openly that there's too much guilt in German society about the Holocaust. This is the type of party that people like Musk, Trump, etc. are promoting. You have like parties like Geert Wilders, PVV in the Netherlands. They're the biggest party in the Dutch parliament now. They have the immigration minister position and they literally talk about the great replacement theory like in parliament that like migrants are coming to basically replace the white European population in Europe. That's what the immigration minister talks about almost on a daily basis. In England, you've got this guy, Nigel Farage. His Reform UK party is surging in the polls at the moment against a very, very right-wing authoritarian Labour government and a Conservative party that's basically in one of the worst crises ever in its 200-year history. Last year, there were actually racist riots across UK cities initiated by fascist groups that were emboldened by the sort of like climate that Farage and the mainstream have been able to generate. So the picture is pretty bleak and terrifying. That's not all there is to this picture, but I'll get into some of that in a second. And neither is it the same everywhere, but you can say there's some general features to this period on the far right. So they're in power in a number of countries. There's a number of authoritarian regimes that they control that can become an inspiration for other countries. There's a whole number of far right and fascist parties surging electorally in different countries, creating the fertile ground for violent street movements. And all this is taking place against the backdrop of quite extreme, increasing inter-imperialist rivalry between the US and China, and rising tensions, rising militarism all across the world. Europe's massively increasing its military spending. Australia has been ramping up its military spending. That's a dynamic that's taking place in the background. Like I said, it's not the only dynamic, though. There is crisis and polarization to the right, but there's also crisis and polarization to the left has been a feature of recent years and decades. So like in the last decade or more, there's actually been revolts all across the world in a number of countries against neoliberalism. So in the 2000s, there was a wave of uprisings across Latin America after the GFC. If anyone Saw Hashem speaking here earlier. There's the Arab Spring, the Egyptian Revolution, what have you. That spread to Europe, the occupation of the squares in Greece, etc., that went to occupy Wall Street. There's also a period of democratic uprisings in Algeria, Sudan, mass protests in Hong Kong, Chile, Ecuador, Colombia, Lebanon, Haiti, whole bunch of different countries in 2019. That flowed into the pandemic as well. There's Black Lives Matter under Trump's first administration, and all of the massive outpouring of solidarity that happened all across the world are in response to that. More recently, there's been the movement in solidarity with Palestine and huge mobilizations against the far right in places like Germany, revolts in Serbia and Turkey happening right now against very, very right-wing authoritarian far-right governments, I would say. Some of this has found electoral expression or a whole bunch of different political projects and what have you that have all been either like crushed, sold out, or they're in some, you know, indeterminate space at the moment. So you had like the Pink Tide governments in Latin America. You had Syriza in Greece. You had Podemos in the Spanish state. You had Jeremy Corbyn in the UK. You had Bernie Sanders in the US, who's, you know, trying to make his, how many comebacks is that now? You have Jean-Luc Mélenchon in France. You have Die Linke in Germany. It's found an electoral expression, but you'd really say that the main dynamic in terms of setting the tone and politics in the mainstream has been the right. But at the same time, it's not the only dynamic that's going on. So what the hell is going on and how do we get into this mess? I think we need to be concrete looking at each country, because it's like each country has its own different particularities about the balance of forces, political traditions, all this sort of stuff. And a lot of countries don't actually have developed far-right parties. Look at Australia. We're actually, bucking the trend in a lot of ways. But the fact that these parties are growing all across the world means that you can actually make some generalizations that you then have to try and concretize in different countries. So you have right-wing social democratic parties for decades, and establishment progressive parties carrying out vicious attacks on, you know, working class living standards, austerity, tax on wages and conditions, declining living standards, crumbling social services, all of that sort of thing. Those attacks were supercharged after the 2008-2009 global financial crisis. The cost of living crisis has also supercharged them a bit more. And you can see in some places there's even been a collapse of traditional social democratic parties in Europe and what have you. I'll talk about that a bit more in a sec. At the same time, it's not just Labour Party is carrying that out. It's also conservative parties, and they've undergone a process of rightward shift, crisis of legitimacy, some of them radicalizing and whatnot. Yeah, that also combined with extreme racism and Islamophobia, in particular since the war on terror and the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. You have the militarization of borders. You have the locking up of refugees. You have the authoritarian hardening of states to repress political protests in particular. That's all happening in the mainstream of politics. And all of that has combined to create a very, very fertile environment in which far-right and fascist parties have been able to establish themselves in across the world. See, you take the fascists in France, it was actually in the 1980s that they were able to establish themselves as a force in mainstream politics. It was under a right-wing socialist government that was carrying out austerity and using racism and whipping it up to basically try and deflect blame away from their government. That enabled them to, when the GFC happened, be a very, very well-established party in the mainstream. They've been able to capitalize on the crisis. Since then, they've been able to play themselves as an opposition to a very, very right-wing establishment, liberal centrist government under Macron. They've really been able to set the pace of politics in France. Trump in the US is slightly different because the right-wing radicalization has actually happened through a traditional conservative party, one of the oldest capitalist parties in the world, in fact. You can look at Hungary, the Fidesz party there, traditional conservative party. That's now a far-right party. You can look at other countries where there's been these dynamics. I don't have time to go through them all. It's something maybe want to take up in the discussion. But the important thing to note is that it's the mainstream political parties of capitalism that are helping facilitate their growth and driving their success. So right-wing social democratic parties and so-called progressive establishment parties, increasingly right-wing conservative parties, authoritarian hardening of states, climate of racism, all this is a fertile environment for the growth of the far right. So let's try and develop a deeper understanding of some of these forces. How are they similar and how they're different from some of the interwar formations. Where do they get their support from? Well, like interwar fascism in the far right, they have their main base of support, like the people who, you know, their most loyal voters, the people that make up the bulk of their party memberships, which aren't actually that big, and their party activists, their cadre and their leadership, the candidates they run in elections and so on. These are drawn primarily from the middle classes. So who are the middle classes? They're a relatively amorphous layer in society caught between the two major classes of capitalism, the big capitalists and the working class. They look slightly different in the interwar period compared to today, but they include small capitalists, like business owners in urban areas, small farmers, not as prevalent today, shopkeepers in rural areas, also not as prevalent today, low-level managers who carry out, you know, directives of bigger capitalists above them over the workers below them, state officials in sections of the capitalist state apparatus, professionals like doctors, lawyers, dentists, accountants, self-employed people, and so on. So why are these people drawn to the far right? I think it's that, like, as a class, they don't have very much social power. So when you think about when these people are frustrated at the state of the world, what can they do about it? They can basically the most they can do is go out in the street and protest and demand the state to do something. They're not like workers. If workers are pissed off about something, you can go much further than that. You can not just go out in the streets. You can go out and strike. You know, that whole basis in society is actually allows them to reshape society in a fundamentally democratic way. And the middle classes can be drawn behind, you know, more progressive things in certain periods where the left is stronger. They're on the move, that sort of thing. But in times of social economic crisis where the left is not actually able to present an alternative, for the most part, these people are drawn behind the right. Their class position makes them particularly prone to far-right and fascist political ideology, a political worldview that presents itself as radical but is in fact fundamentally reactionary. The little guy against the big guy, the marginalized against elites in the state, those social layers deemed to be responsible and working together through usually shadowy international networks and cabals. I think one important... Actually, this is something that's also the same as the interwar period. These people actually, these parties receive significant backing from capitalists. So if you look at Trump's whole administration, if you just look at the inauguration, it's basically the entire capitalist class just lining up behind this guy. It presents themselves as radical and against the establishment. In fact, they are very much part of the establishment. If you also look at their leaderships, they're also quite wealthy. So, you know, Trump is fucking Nepo baby billionaire. Alice Weidel from the AfD in Germany is in fact a high-ranking banker. The Nigel Farage is a very, very failed banker, apparently. So, you know, they're quite wealthy and often, you know, capitalists or the servants of capitalists themselves. One important difference, though, in the interwar period is that there's actually more electoral support for these far-right parties comparatively than there was in the interwar period. And we can't ignore that fact. Like in places like France, there's a big blue-collar vote for the far-right party there. In Austria, it's similar. So we don't want to just like brush that aside and say that that doesn't exist. But we can explain, I think, why things like this exist. So in the interwar period, there existed mass communist parties, social democratic parties, mass trade unions. This all had an influence on the shape of working life, working class life, their experiences, their politics and whatnot. And it could act as a bulwark against the far right, even when they, you know, they sell out and stuff. So it'd usually be the most backwards workers that could be drawn in but behind the far right. Today, the picture is very, very radically different. There are no mass communist parties. There are no, social democratic parties that are a pathetic romp in most places. Most workers aren't members of political parties or trade unions. Most of them haven't been out on strike or have no experience of that. Added to this, it's been those parties, social democratic parties, that have been associated with the left that have been carrying out vicious attacks on people's living standards. So it basically provides a whole space in which the far right have been able to present themselves as being for the little, you know, the little guy and all that sort of thing. At the same time, you don't want to overstate it. Their primary base of support, I think, is voting bases amongst the middle classes. The leaderships of these parties are overwhelmingly quite wealthy and they get support from the capitalists. Another important difference with the interwar period is that the support for these parties is primarily electoral. Like they're primarily electoral formations And whereas in the interwar period, you had electoral formations, but you also had mass street fighting formations connected to them. They're often fused in the same party. And we have to also explain why that's the case. So in the interwar period, I think it was because of extreme crisis and class struggle. You had inter-imperialist conflict, world war, mass slaughter. You had an economic crisis that was like nothing the capitalist system has ever seen, the Great Depression and whatnot. And you had revolution and counter-revolution. All of these things required extreme solutions by the capitalist class to deal with the crisis. And they dealt with that from above and below. So from above, using austerity measures combined with extreme counter-revolutionary violence and terror to try and carry these things out. And from below, mass fascist movements. So it could go around, frenzied gangs and paramilitary groups, squads, little armies, big armies, police forces and what have you, going around terrorizing, beating up, often murdering workers, members of the left and anyone they deemed part of it, anyone that was deemed a threat to them and society more broadly in their fucked up worldview. They often worked in tandem with the state, but also to maintain a degree of independence. So if you look at Mussolini's squads, they were actually raised primarily initially by landowners, but they also had their own independent logic. Similar with the Freikorps in Germany, it was a social democratic government that first raised them. They were demobilized soldiers. They ended up trying to overthrow the German government after they crushed the German Revolution. Hitler's brown shirts, more independent. So they weren't just a brute instrument of the capitalist class. They had their own semi-independence to them, which unleashed the capitalists couldn't really control, which is one of the things that they found them quite risky. So the main point is that it was the most extreme capitalist crisis that the world has ever seen, and the extreme measures used to deal with it had an impact on how the far right looked and what it was able to do. So if you look at today, why don't we have gangs of middle-class frenzied people going around doing this? Is basically, they look at the level of the crisis, there's nothing compared to it. It's quite a serious crisis that we're going through, but it's not the same degree of inter-imperialist war and conflict. It's not as developed yet. I think we're in the early stages of seeing a lot of these happen. A lot of these things happen. Governments are trying to prepare ourselves for that eventuality. The economic crisis is clearly everyone's looked at their rent or their grocery bills and what have you, but it's not the same level of mass unemployment and economic destitution and misery, at least in Australia. Australia's as good as it gets, as Omar said at the opening light last night. Even in Europe, it's not the same degree as what existed during the Great Depression. And the left polarization that I spoke about earlier, it's reached nothing of the levels of actually presenting itself as a revolutionary challenge to state power and what have you. Things can develop in the future, but it's not at that point yet. So among these formations that have developed, there's some important differences among them. And I think it's also important to understand what's going on with them so we can see the shape of the far right looks today. It's also very fluid. So none of these categories I'm going to discuss are actually mutually exclusive. They often morph into each other and contain different elements of each other. So you have rightward moving conservative parties, and sometimes radicalizing conservative parties. Trump, the Republicans under Trump is the most extreme case of this dynamic. And with the Capitol riots and what happened during BLM, you had far right, Trump supporters out in the streets trying to put down protests in cahoots with the cops and stuff. You can see that the boundaries between the electoral far right and the extra parliamentary far right are not mutually exclusive. And it has been a dynamic of recent years that there has been extra parliamentary movements and what have you. So it's not to say that there isn't any, but they're comparatively small. There's not heaps of support for them amongst any section of the establishment and what have you. But Trump is he's a pretty loose cannon. There are a lot of other examples that you can look into this dynamic. Like the British Tories at the moment are going through an extreme crisis. Orban in Hungary, I mentioned before. The CDU that's in Germany that's now heading a grand coalition government. Their new Chancellor Merz is one of the most far-right type figures that they've had in a number of years. The OVP in Austria, which is the Conservative Party, they were coalition governments of the far-right multiple times and pretty much indistinguishable in a lot of their politics. So it's also, this is not actually happening everywhere either. You can see what's happened in Australia. The Liberal Party tried to do a whole Trumpy thing and it's backfired predominantly in terms of how much the Labor Party's been able to try and wedge them. They've benefited from that. So it's not the case that this dynamic just plays itself out everywhere. You have to look at the kind of specificities of each country. But it's definitely to say that this is a dynamic going on the right today across the world. The reason that is happening is, as I said before, there's challenges to the mainstream parties. And it's important to understand who those challenges are, because the conservative parties have been trying to, you know, shift more rightwards, thinking they could win more voters on a right-wing basis, but they're actually legitimizing the far right and, you know, losing votes to them and what have you, and being surpassed. So the first set of challenges are what are commonly referred to as right-wing populist parties. Examples include Farage's party in the UK, his predecessor parties, the Italian Liga, Wilders, etc. Unlike traditional conservatives, they can tend to have a more electoralist approach, but at the same time, they can help create a more favorable environment for far-right street movements. And they often have Nazis and fascists operating in their ranks. So it's not also not mutually exclusive. And if you look at what happened with the riots last year, you could really see the dynamics of, like, you know, street agitators like Tommy Robinson agitating for, you know, violent street politics. And then Nigel Farage will get up on TV and say, oh, you know, I'm not against violence or whatever, but they all have legitimate concerns and maybe we have to, you know, listen to what they're saying, what have you. Tries, you can see the dynamic that can be opened up in times of crisis between these two elements. Then you have neo-fascist parties, which have their roots predominantly in the interwar fascist tradition, and it's basically restricted to Western Europe. There's other examples, like the BJP in India is a similar kind of thing, but it's also a very different part of the world, and I don't really want to get into that. People can discuss that in the discussion if they want to, but I just want to focus on Europe because, you know, it has a bigger impact here. So the FBO in Austria, the National Rally in France, Maloney's Brothers of Italy, all these parties have deprioritized building street movements for now, but they have an orientation towards creating, you know, much more viciously right-wing political environments, authoritarian states, and what have you. And it raises the question, is it right to still call these parties fascist, or are they something else? And, like, why would it even matter to what you call them? Like, it's a big, you know, it's a relevant question, because most of the time the way it gets referred to is, like, really academic and semantic. It's like, oh, do they fit into this category or that category? You take up a model of what the far-right parties look like in the interwar period. I think this is not a very, sophisticated approach to understanding far-right formations. And it matters because the concepts we use to grasp them is like, how do we actually understand them in reality? Like, what are they? What sort of threat do they represent? What could they develop into if they remain unchallenged? And what have you, not contained and defeated? So some people say they're not fascist. Why? Because they don't have because they have a focus on electoralism and they're not building street movements, you can no longer call them fascists. I think the thing about having an electoral approach isn't a sufficient criteria to rule out whether something's fascist or not. Like, all the interwar fascists use the parliamentary arena, and it's been a strategy that they've, you know, consistently used. Mussolini and Hitler's parties used it, try and gain more respectability in the state, and whilst having your, you know, street fighting movement on the streets. So how can we know whether these parties are fascist or not? We can look at their origins, their leaderships and their cadres. So the FPO, you know, set up by Nazi officers from the Second World War. The cadre and the leadership are generated out of these right-wing student fraternities, which I won't even try and pronounce because my German's not great at the moment. But yeah, all of this, all of the people that control this party and all of the neo-Nazis in Austria are actually generated out of these neo-Nazi cater schools, as they're called. In France, it's similarly, like, the origins of the party, the leaderships, and a section, like, you know, section of the caters and what have you, were all drawn from various French fascist traditions, and they actually set up the party on that basis of how do we rehabilitate French fascism in the aftermath of all of the crimes and horrors of the Second World War that we're associated with. Today, like, I think there's still a core of these people that are part of the FN apparatus, and they still have connections to street fighting groups and what have you. Similarly with Maloney's Fratelli in Italy, that was born out of right-wing split out of another party. All these people have their traditions in the heir to the Mussolini's party, the Italian social movement. So we can also look at the politics and political strategies that predominate amongst these parties and their leaderships. All of them use state power to promote, their politics, their traditions, and build their organizations. So if you look at the fascist intellectuals who set up the FN, they had a very explicit strategy. That I've actually read some of their stuff. They call themselves right Gramscians. It's very, very messed up. So in the way that like revolutionary Marxists would use the parliamentary arena and the state to try and, build extra parliamentary movements, try and undermine it, eventually smash it and replace it with workers' power. The fascists try to adapt that to their own right-wing strategy. It was like, oh, we can use the parliament. We can get into the state. We can get into the repressive arms. We can do all these things that Marxists can't do. Or, some of them did try and that's obviously disastrous. But they could get a base in the state and use that to create more favorable conditions. And it was a very, very worked out strategy of deprioritizing street movements because they just keep on getting smashed every time they try and build them. The left was way stronger. And it was the sort of post-war period was not conducive to that. The fascists in Austria have actually really perfected this strategy. The last coalition government that they were in, they made control of the interior ministry and the police part of the condition of joining that coalition government, as the head of the interior ministry was sending out official advertisements of the Ministry of Interior to all those neo-Nazi cadre schools recruiting into the police. They do that alongside massively empowering the police, giving them way more police powers to deport people, all of these sort of things. They set up their own unions in the police, and they've actually built a base of cadre and membership in the police through that project. And Hickel, the guy that oversaw that, is now the leader of the FPO. Maloney's party is doing a similar thing to some extent. It's just last week, I think it was, passed a decree to provide police officers with legal protection for basically any violence that they commit against protesters or anyone. They have basically legal immunity for that. So I think all of these parties contain a fascist core of people within them masquerading or camouflaging themselves as right-wing populists, conservatives, these other things. And they're winning people on the basis of they're not that. Like they're just run-of-the-mill conservatives, but then they're trying to get people closer to them and what their real politics are through various activities and stuff. So that creates a tension in these parties. They can moderate. They can just become our run-of-the-mill conservatives. Like that's what happened to the FBO in the early 2000s, I think it was. They joined a coalition government with the conservatives. A whole rump of it just became conservatives. They led a split by this guy, Haider. And the state and government led to a huge crisis in the FPO. It was rebuilt by this guy, Strucker, on a much harder basis. He's a dentist by trade, which you might be able to tell by the first photo. But you can't really in the second photo because he's in military gear. Literally the entire, a whole bunch of the hardcore cadre and leadership of the current FPO have all undergone military training for civil war. It's one of the things that they do in these right-wing student fraternities. So that these are serious neo-fascists, I would say. And that points to another thing. It's like these parties can radicalize. The AfD in Germany started off as like a right-wing populist neoliberal technocratic party set up by professors, but also with a bunch of fascists involved in it and a bunch of hardcore conservatives. The hardcore conservatives and the fascists then rolled all the technocrats. And then there's been an alliance between these wings, and the fascists keep on pushing things to the right in that party, and they really control a whole bunch of the apparatus. So it's a hybrid thing that's emerged out of that process as well. So the point of that is to actually just illustrate that the boundaries between conservatives, right-wing populists and fascists aren't rigid. All of these formations to some extent are hybrids and can undergo mutation and transformation under certain conditions. Parties like the FPO, RN and Fratelli, they retain potential to transform themselves into more traditional classical fascist parties under the right conditions of extreme crisis and class struggle that I pointed to earlier. And there's a formal institutional division between like street fighting groups and the parliamentary formations, but that division is also not like just rigid. They actually interact a lot and they can play a mutually reinforcing role in the growth of more explicit fascist extra parliamentary far-right groups. So you see what happened in the US with the Capital Riots or the UK more recently. So it raises another question about the type of regimes that come that are constructed when these parties come to power. Are they fascists? The most throwaway thing you see in the mainstream today, like Trump's America, they're all like, oh, it's all fascists and, you know, that sort of thing. I think that's quite demobilizing because, like, if you actually look at the conditions under which states go fascist, I think there are two conditions. And one of them is that, like, you have to have mass paramilitary street fighting organizations capable of smashing the organized working class and left. None of that exists anywhere in the world, even in places where they're bigger. None of that exists. The ruling class would need to seek the destruction of liberal democracy as well as being another condition. And that doesn't exist either on anywhere in the world. So at the same time, that's true, but we also need to look at the dynamics around some of these regimes. So you look at Trump's America, as I said, he's got a very, very authoritarian right-wing nationalist project that's primarily, you know, electoral. He's using the traditional arms of the state to carry it out. But at the same time, he's shifted politics massively to the right and created conditions in which these more, you know, fascistic groups can grow. You look at other regimes, like Trump is not the only way to do authoritarianism. Like you look at Maloney or Orban, other people like that, Modi, they're much more strategic and less confrontational. And they're, you know, they're actually much better at doing authoritarianism than Trump because he's so erratic. He provokes, you know, so much, you know, disgust and outrage. So they're actually way more politically serious than them. At the same time, they're clearly watching what Trump is able to get away with, and they're like, oh, what could we get away with in our own populations and what have you? So none of these regimes are infallible. They can overreach, they can make mistakes, they can fuck up, can provoke mass resistance. They can also lead to the, you know, the center and the establishment being rejuvenated out of that process. So the direction of these regimes isn't, you know, uniform. It's not predetermined. It's impacted by, you know, different decisions that political forces make. And it's also important to recognize that, you know, the far right is not the only way to do authoritarianism. Like the liberal center is very, very effective at doing this. You look at Macron in France, he's done more to rehabilitate French fascism than anyone else, you know, in history. Starmer in the UK, Labour governments here, the Democrats in the US paved the way for this administration in Trump's administration right now. So all of it, you know, the establishment is also carried out a project of authoritarianism, militarization, and what have you. And the left is less willing to mobilize against these people. Yeah. Okay. So I've been told to hurry up and finish. This raises an important question about what we can do. I think there's two things that we can do that are interconnected. One of them is building politically independent mass movements that can take these forces on in the streets and in the states. The second thing, which I think is it's a precondition in some senses, but it can be a driver of the growth of the first one, is building up revolutionary organizations with the goal of smashing up not just the fascists and the far right, but the entire political establishment and the ruling class. These aren't new ideas. They're grounded in a long tradition and history. And you can see some of that playing out in the world today. So you have in the first instance, in Germany, there's mass protests. You have in the response in the UK, there was mass protests to the street fascists there that actually, I think, stopped a whole bunch of lynchings, potential lynchings and killings of migrants and Muslims. You have in Australia been involved in the campaign against racism and fascism that has managed to push back the far right. The precondition for success in a lot of those in all those instances, it has actually been the revolutionary left growing and building itself to be able to launch those things and actually recruiting more people out of that process. You can see we have to fight them when they're in government. So what's happening in the US at the moment? There's the early signs of resistance. To actually stop something like Trump, you'd actually have to, I think, do a lot more than just mobilize in the streets. You'd have to follow some of the things that are happening in Argentina, the mass general strikes and what have you. They've got a bigger revolutionary left there. They're more organized than the left in the US. So there's, you know, a big task ahead of what's going on in the US. We have to prevent the far right from gaining a foothold in parliaments. Like the fact that they weren't able to stop them in the 80s in France was actually a big setback. They weren't big enough. Baptiste is here. He can talk about it. He's French. You can go to his session tomorrow as well. It'd be really good. But even when they're lodged in parliament, you can dislodge them. So there was actually an attempt in the 90s to do that. The rising class struggle, the left was in a better, comparatively a better state, actually caused a split in the FN through mass mobilizations. It was an opportunity to rout and smash them, which was missed because of the main politics on the left is one of not actually building politically independent movements and what have you. And the whole logic of lesser evilism, which we see in places like the US, you know, you see that with vote Labour because we don't want Dutton, all of this sort of stuff is a feature of mainstream left politics, not actually wanting to build an independent left-wing pole of attraction to smash these people. Macron has used that very effectively against the left in France. That actually backfired last year in the general election. There was a big vote for the left, a coalition of left-wing parties around this guy, Mélenchon. There's a lot of contradictions to it, but like you can say on one level, they actually stopped there being a far-right presidency. But the problem with the whole thing, well, actually, the good thing about it, it shows that if you present a left-wing alternative, people will flock to that. The bad thing about it is like it's strictly an electoral formation. All of this energy and like enthusiasm that they could generate out of a left-wing project, you know, they're not trying to turn that into a mass street food movement that, and, you know, workplace movement, etc. They can smash not just the fascists because they haven't gone away, but smash the entire mainstream establishment who's responsible for this mess. So here in Australia, we've got, you know, relatively a better situation, if you could call it that. Like we don't actually have a mass far-right movement entrenched in the state and what have you. But that being said, there's objective and subjective reasons for that. Objectively, like the crisis isn't bad, but there's a lot of the similar conditions that could create that situation. On the other hand, subjectively, the far right here are pretty pathetic. Like Pauline Hanson has occupied, political space for a whole bunch of years and not been able to turn that into anything, you know, bigger. That's not a reason to be complacent. That's just to say that, like, you know, we don't face the same problems as the European left and what have you around the far right. But there's a few things that we can do immediately in the coming period. We can get involved with the rally to cut ties with Trump's America on May 24. That's happening all around the country. That's how we can, you know, continue to build on an anti-fascist, anti-far-right, anti-authoritarian sentiment. There's quite clearly a thing here in Australia. You can get involved with Victorian Socialists in the upcoming federal election, the most boring federal election ever, potentially, except for the fact that Victorian Socialists is involved in it. It's an opportunity to spread socialist ideas, get out there, talk to people about left-wing politics and build a left-wing fighting alternative to the mainstream and the far right. And you can also build socialist alternative. If you haven't thought about joining us yet, I would highly encourage that you do consider that. Revolutionary Marxists are the people that are trying to build a different type of society. We actually have a vision. We have politics. We have an organization. We want to fight. We want to be the people that other people look to and they don't despair. They see hope. They see, you know, a genuine alternative and whatnot. Because if we don't fight for that, the alternative is increasing barbarism. We're clearly going down the same path as other countries in the world, militarism, authoritarianism, or what have you. And the choice is very clear. It's between socialism or barbarism. And we want people to see that the choice is socialism. So thank you.